You are listening to The Conversation. This is Michael Shaw. Welcome. Hi. I don't think I need to tell you who Amanda Rosso is, do I? I presume you know. If you don't, do a quick search. You will find plenty. I do want to introduce the fact that we have a live website now for the show. It is a not a permanent URL, but it is a working URL. It is theconversationpodcast.madewithcolor.com. That's theconversationpodcast.madewithcolor.com. All the relevant links are there for Facebook, for Twitter, for Notes on Looking, and you will find bonus images, including some studio cameo shots with the participants, as well as images of work. So go check it out. Today, madewithcolor.com is our sponsor. Go check out Made with Color for easy-to-build website foundations for artist types and the like, creative types. Go check it out. I want to welcome those of you in Chicago who may be an added demographic today. Hey, Chi-Town. Welcome to you. Does it sound okay that I'm saying Chi-Town? Does that not sound weird, not being a local? Many years ago when I was living in New York, I went out on a date with this woman who was from the Bay Area, from the East Bay, but I mentioned at one point Frisco, and she had this very disappointed look on her face and was simply saying something like, no. So hey, Chi-Town, welcome. Those of you who think you know Amanda's work back to front to back, and I can't imagine there are that many of you, you're going to find, listening to this conversation, that there are things that you probably didn't quite know or understand in terms of the approach that Amanda has towards her work. Those of you who are bewildered by her work or maybe have some questions, I think you'll have a lot more clarity about it. So stay tuned for that. I want to tell you that Amanda Rosso has been really great to collaborate with. I honestly didn't have any particular expectations going in. I suppose more subconsciously I might have been a little bit intimidated or something along the likes, but Amanda has been great. Eric Friedenberg, her partner and studio mate, has also been great. And go listen to Eric Friedenberg's podcast from last week if you haven't already. Of course, did a back-to-back, so I went to their studio, did Eric's interview first, and then Amanda, and so go listen to Eric's as well. Let's see. So that's about it. Stay tuned, please, after the conversation winds down for some important information about the podcast, and thank you again for being here, and I will talk to you later. Pretty interesting name. So, mm-hmm, I mean, mm-hmm, something that I've been thinking, wondering, because of my association with the name Ho, is that it's Hawaiian. Do you know of any Hawaiian connections? What's that?
Because of Don. Don Ho.
No. Actually, there's a Derek Ho and a Mike Ho who are surfers.
Oh, okay.
Back in the 80s.
Okay, I don't know my surfers. I am not Hawaiian, but my dad is Chinese, my mom's Italian. And
wow.
Ho is, yeah, so the deal, and I'll get to the Hawaiian thing. The reason my name is hyphenated is that my parents decided to give me both names as my last name. So it's a hyphenated name that was given to me, you know, by them. So my mom kept her last name, and so they decided to do it that way. I had nothing to do with it. So, so I am the only Ross Ho.
With no hyphen.
With a hyphen.
Oh, it is a hyphen.
Yeah.
Rosso.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Hyphen.
It's funny, I don't remember the hyphen.
Anyway. It often gets omitted because of, like, computer issues. Like, I actually, in terms of, like, the way the world organizes me, I have, like, 100 names, actually. Because some won't take the hyphen. So some, like, with American Airlines, I'm one word, Rosso. So it really depends on the database.
We're not necessarily talking about the Googling of yourself, right?
No. It has to do with whether or not there's a field to accept that special character.
Right.
But no, so Ho is Chinese. And, but it was originally, well, it's a longer story, but Yeah, that's the family name, but it was originally Han, and then there were some...
So Ross is the Italian?
It is, and that was also a different name. So that was Rossi.
Ah.
And so many of my family members have actually added the I back on. So our family is funny because it's compounded by Ross's and Rossi's. This is my mom's side.
Okay.
So some people kind of decided to keep it or reinstitute it because they wanted to, you know, retain the kind of original family name. But if I'm correct, my great-grandfather dropped it. So, anyway. So I'm Ross, and my mom is Ross, but then she's got six siblings, and so many of them are Rossi, so it's funny. So actually, when we do family events, which we're about to do for Thanksgiving, we usually get, you know, so we send mass emails because we have a really big family, and so it's usually like Rossi, or Ross/I, because it's like, everybody.
So the Rossis are big family, are the hosts of big
sides,
family?
Yeah, huge, actually, both sides. Wow. Yeah. So I don't have any siblings. I am an OC, but my mom is oldest of seven, and my dad is second youngest of seven. And they all have, you know,
that's
spouses
pretty,
and children.
That's,
and
so you're like the golden child after
kind
all that.
Kind of. Well, yeah. And then my mom is much younger than my dad. So on my mom's side, I'm the oldest, or I'm the first grandchild. And then my dad's, I'm much further down the line because he's, you know, younger, or he's older than her. He's about 11 years older than her. So his...
I don't know if 11 years qualifies as much older, does
I
it?
I think so. Well, okay. Enough where, you know, generationally, yeah. On that side of the family, I'm not nearly the first grandkid.
I see.
You know what I'm saying? Because his oldest sister is, like, much older. Anyway, so if you do the math, that's like thousands of cousins, basically.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a really big family.
And are they spread out all over the place?
Yeah, so, yeah, they're everywhere.
Well, what's really curious to me is if you have an Italian heritage, mm-hmm. which is so obviously, you know, Latin and warm, you know, or hot even. But Chinese, I mean, isn't that such a broad nationality that you wouldn't want to put it in either camp? That would be my guess.
My experience, you know, having my dad was born in Shanghai and moved when he was 20 or 19 or so. And I don't know if it's just my family, because I think my family is actually they're pretty crazy. They're like pretty unique. They're very fiery people. They're very fiery. They have a great, this is my Chinese, they have a great sense of humor. They're hilarious. They're super wacky, like really wacky.
Yeah.
So I don't think, I couldn't associate from my own personal, like, internal experience at all. I couldn't file them any other way. But that's also just my imprint because it's them. So it's hard for me to say. I think I just don't know enough. Because my dad actually never went home. He's never been home. So, and I'm only
since he left
Shanghai. In 1955.
Wow.
So in my, but his siblings have gone back, you know, many of them go back annually or whatever. So my kind of relationship to it is really just culturally is kind of once removed through his experience. And also because my mom's not Chinese, you know, it's much more hybridized kind of upbringing.
Yeah.
But then my cousins have, you know, many of them have two Chinese parents, and then many of them are all mixed up. Like, we have Dutch Chinese, we have German Chinese, we're kind of like all over the place. So, but yeah, I'm sure. I just don't, my kind of relationship to it is pretty much through those people who are, yeah, they have like a pretty, you know, interesting kind of colorful, I don't know, they're pretty wild. So I don't think they're a typical Chinese family, let's just say.
Yeah.
In a weird sense. There's a lot of artists. It's very, like, they're pretty awesome. They're pretty special. So, but yeah, so I don't know.
Well, yeah. I have to figure out where to begin asking questions beyond just the name thing, because that's always an easy
answer. Yeah, no, that's an easy one.
Because I think I was almost tempted to put a Facebook or tweet out or something asking what kind of questions they might have for you. But I think I'm going to go this on my own. So
that's fine.
Yeah. I think I really am tempted to start with this association that has been established. I don't know how widely, but it's not important, that you were and are maybe the precocious or just the really sharp art school sort of, you know, character. Is that something you've heard at all before?
Not in those words, I don't think.
Okay.
Like, what do you mean?
Yeah, well, in other words, if you're in a class of people, like in grad school or what have you.
Wait, did you hear this from a grad student?
No.
Which is fine.
I'm actually quoting a sort of written description, basically.
Okay.
Which I won't reveal right now because we don't want to bias things any more than we already are.
Well, it depends on, I guess, what you mean by it. Like, I guess I don't automatically, I'm familiar with the writing that's been done about the work. I don't think that I can think of, unless it was terms that maybe I read it differently. I can't recall.
Good.
So, I guess the answer is no. I don't think of that as a generalization that I feel like I have. There are others.
Such as?
So what are the generalizations that people...
Yeah.
I'd say this is starting to get a little worked out of the system, but there was a period where there was a perception or sort of a description of the work that I was interested in clutter, and that just drove me bananas because that is like not at all what I'm interested in. I'm interested in stuff and how it moves, and I'm interested in the way that material accumulates around activity, but I'm not interested in clutter. And
that's a really specific description. And I'm talking about something much more general.
Yeah. No, I was just thinking of something that nags at me sometimes.
Sure.
And again, it's been kind of worked out. You know, it's like it came up a couple of times. I understand why people used it because, you know, I was using garbage and detritus and things like that. So I get why, you know, you would go there. But I felt like it was a dangerous term because it was, like, loaded with this other stuff that I wasn't into. But, and then, you know, I do heavily reference the studio. And so I do sometimes, or, you know, not even just reference, invoke, whatever. And sometimes I do worry, but it's like anything. I worry a little bit about the level of institutional critique. Like, that's not really my concern, although it's implied. And so sometimes I have to work on the knobs, like dialing that down just to make sure that that isn't the only, you know, ultimately the only read. Because it's important. I mean, that is part of it for sure. I mean, you can't separate from it.
You did have a big institutional critique gesture in this last show at Mocha, right?
Yeah.
With you and the article.
Yeah. But I guess, like... Is it... Oh, you mean the Basquiat thing, or...?
No, the photograph of you with your cat...
Yeah.
There was a sort of reproduction of the catalog that was in the show.
Kind of. Well, that photo actually has a more specific story.
Oh, it relates to a Basquiat photo?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, do you want to go there? Because we can go there.
I think
it's a little bit of a yarn, so maybe let's
yeah.
I like everything. It's like, don't pull that string, cause...
Right. Well, I think the institutional critique thing is a valid and important thing. All this that we've been talking about is what it's making me remember that I wanted to point out is I think there's a coolness to the work. Mm-hmm. That goes back to what we were talking about with your heritage, you know, because it seems like you have kind of a warm personality, and you also have kind of warm, you know, ancestry as well. And how do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah,
you just made an Italian gesture.
Yeah. I was like, how do you, I was like, oh, right, we're not transcribing, so you can't parenthetically be like, makes...
No, you can just say what you're doing.
Stereotypical Italian.
If somebody makes air quotes, I say, you just made air quotes.
Oh, air quotes, yeah. Sorry. I actually missed the very last part of what you said because I was...
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. So
the warmness.
Yeah. So I'll just say what I said again. I'll say what I said was you make work that does have a certain coolness to it.
Very like temperature.
Temperature.
Yeah.
Conceptual.
Yeah. Totally uncool.
Dry at times. You know, dry on top of wet. There's a lot of wet physicality, but then there's dry, like, cloaked over.
Yeah, that's intentional.
And yet you personally have this warmth. And like we were talking about at the beginning, you have this warm Italian ancestry, and then you have this warm Chinese ancestry.
A lot of yelling.
Exactly.
There's a lot of yelling on both sides of my family.
Wow.
A lot of noodles, a lot of
yelling. Well, that explains a little bit, because your work is kind of yelling at each other, but in a very, but I guess in a very cool kind of way.
Well, I mean, I was born.
It's not yelling, it's referencing parts of itself.
But there is like a general condition of chaos that I think is my primal scene for sure. In one
controlled chaos.
No, I think just chaos, but and perhaps like, you know, the effort to order that chaos is like the work or something. But as far as like the coolness, I mean that's really intentional. All of that coolness, it's a tricky thing to talk about in the way that I've been thinking about it for the last few years. Is this idea that all of the gestures are really a combination of like super intuitive sort of human maneuvers, you know, just kind of natural or chance or inadvertent or, you know, whatever words you want to use. And then kind of a schizophrenic balance between that and analysis of that. And so it's it's kind of a tricky thing to explain or describe, and hopefully the work does the best job of it. But it's like, for me, the concern or the interest is to, you know, create that sort of leveled hierarchy between those things, but also to create a condition where, in a way, that coolness is intentionally kind of meant to feel a little stilted, to call attention to sort of, in a way, the absurdity of like how warm the stuff actually is. So, in other words, like if I didn't put the gestures that I'm making in that kind of analytic light, in my opinion, as the maker, this is my decision, this is how I'm making this stuff. If I didn't cast that analytic light, there would be too much danger to fall into the seduction of the impulse, right? Like you're gonna feel, oh, this like paint splatters on a surface can only mean one thing, but if I introduce the second voice that's not only the maker but the observer of that, like there's really two voices. And I think that that's been my interest over the last few years, is to kind of combine those things and really present this. I mean, they're sort of seamless in the sense that like you're just looking at, I mean, you're looking at a continuous kind of surface, if you will, but there's interjections with framing or sort of meta languages, and there's sort of all the stuff that's wound into for me to suggest those two different voices, where you're shifting between that view of what it feels like to just, I mean, it's like, it's not about mark making, but like a mark is a good example, you know, like just the impulse. And then like what happens when you look at that and like analyze it or frame it or kind of try to synthesize that or process it. And I think that like sometimes that that coolness that you're experiencing is like for me, that's really intentional, because I want you to feel almost a sense of like a science is being performed. You know, that there's not free expression. It's expression.
It's a quelling of free expression.
Well, and it's an expression, but it's also like a study of it. You know, I'm studying my own expression, and that's really sort of what you're seeing. You know, and that's hard, because sometimes I think what I like to do, or I hope to do, is really, hopefully, like, demand a lot of a viewer. Like, that's kind of a tricky thing to ask someone to decode. But, like, for me, that's a way of, like, respecting the intelligence of somebody as they're synthesizing information. And hopefully creating a condition where you go out into the world, and then that stuff becomes both, you know, a conflation of voices, too. Because it is. It's almost like asking everyone's interpretive apparatus to get fine-tuned. It's like an obstacle course, or like a exercise or something. Or that's
so,
how I think.
So viewers are all the more educated and knowledged after they've gone through the experience.
I don't think you know anything else. It just or my goal would be not that you necessarily go away with like legible information, but that there's like an awareness of your apparatus. That's the only thing I really care about, you know. It's like, is there some, can I create a situation where you're asked to use your brain or maybe exercise muscles of your brain in a little bit of a different way. Like, can you just be can you be conscious, a little bit more conscious than you were when you walked in?
Right.
I guess,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
So the sort of stuff is placeholders for that. So it's like, you know, there's a lot of vocabulary that repeats, in the work, and that's not necessarily because like one particular thing means something, but it becomes a placeholder for meaning. So if you see it again in the sort of course of the linear course of how the work kind of unfolds, for me, that idea is that like that repetition becomes just a trigger to say, oh, I've seen this before. It's not that, you know, a pair of sneakers means anything. It's that it means something right now, or it meant something then. And so it's like the creation of meaning or the production of meaning too. So all the stuff is kind of like, they're stand-ins for that process. Does that make sense? I don't know.
What about the and anti-seduction element? Is there some of that going on as well?
Well, I think the answer is the same as the other answer. It's like there's both. I think I have figured out or have engineered sort of mechanisms to be able to indulge in seduction, but then, you know, also make it have a criticality to it.
Right.
So it's like
have you taken it too?
Yeah, I want it all. I want all that. Sure. I want the whole system. I mean, that's the thing too, is it's really about the system. And
the system of what?
Well,
of the
making? Way any system is a whole, right? So like, mm-hmm. You can't just, for me, it's not about like, what is it? It's like a method of declaring full inclusion rather than the opposite. Like, I think that might just be a way of thinking. For some people, it's about isolating and pulling things out of visual culture or whatever, or visuality, and saying, okay, this has a value, you know, over something else for me and for who I want to read this.
Right.
And I think for me, it's really more of a thought process of like, well, everything's included, but then if that's the case, how do you still present something that isn't completely abstract and does not have a point of entry or a way to sort of move through it? It's like a management system.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So, yeah, I don't know. That's kind of how I think about that.
Well, I think it goes back, where we are now goes back to what you said about how anticipates what my question would then be about what you hope people to feel maybe when they leave, and that is that they've worked muscles in their brain
mm-hmm.
that they haven't been working maybe.
Yeah. But also I wanted to say, well, one thing I want to say about that is this is the part that's the hardest to describe, is that part of that seriousness is theatrical. That like sometimes I'll work into like the titling schema or even the way that I'd like light a show, like this sort of like, almost like a breathless kind of loftiness. And that is really intended to do the things I said before, but also, be a little funny. Like there's like a humor in there that's not, because I think to balance that seriousness, or it's like that's the way to include the seriousness and the humor at the same time. Like there's a way to be like, no, this is really serious. I take this very seriously. But of course, the presence of that means that there's got to be some humor, right? Like there's, and again, that's that holistic kind of thing or whatever. But I didn't really answer your question. I just remembered something
well,
else
no,
I wanted to point out.
You're making me want to use a specific example, which is this show that you had at Mocha PDC.
Yeah.
Recently, called Teeny Tiny Woman, which itself is a hilarious title, and it's almost kind of like you have the title and you know you're good, right?
Sort of.
Kind of.
It's kind of slippery though. People, I mean, there were, I got a lot of different interpretations, and
yeah,
that was kind of the goal too. But
well, let me just interject
yeah.
One element that I can't help continuously being aware of, and I'm sure other people have been as well, is that when you go to see this show called Teeny Tiny Woman. And you go into the main space, and the main object of this of the show, or the central object, if not the main object, this giant enlarger.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of setting up this expectation for, oh, there are going to be all these other things that make me feel like a teeny tiny woman, right? Yeah. But you're not, you know, you're not catering to that low, you know, sort of semi-low common denominator.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, it's on Funhouse, but it was meant to specifically talk about scale. It was meant to make a humorous kind of reference to the gravity of the project, which was supposed to be a survey. It was meant to... It was a perfect title because it referenced so many different things. Number one, it sort of loosely pointed to some psychedelic kind of possibilities like Alice in Wonderland or, you know. And there is a lot of... the whole show is really shifting between kind of what I was talking about before a little bit, the kind of the omnipotent view and then the sort of local view.
Right.
And that was really the intention, was to create this. And it has been in the work for a long time, but this was an opportunity to talk about it in kind of a really big presentation.
Yeah.
And so that became perfect because, you know, it talked about your sort of scale relationship to basically the world. But then it was also kind of like a self-deprecating thing. And then it was also just a reference to the scale of the objects. I thought, how stupid and kind of great would that be if you read this title and then you walk in and everything is, for the most part, at least 12 feet tall. You know, like there's just this relationship with that language. I wanted it to be intentionally contrasting with what you're experiencing. So the enlarger was a central component of the show, and that was really intended to create like a condition for everything that you were seeing. So that, I mean, all the work kind of implicates the viewer, and that's a really important component, that that you don't feel excluded. But then again, you do. But the exclusion hopefully makes you want to connect. You know, so all of those kinds of cues or directions are kind of integrated. And I think a lot about how you move through a space, you know, what draws you in, what can you connect with, what do you then have to kind of complete, what does the condition of being confused produce? You know, like
hold that thought, because I think that's a really
which
vital,
I feel,
central sort of question
exactly
to what you're doing. In fact, it makes me want to ask something that I've been thinking about asking along the description of what you're talking about, which is, from your anecdotal experience, do you find that, I mean, maybe this is the kind of thing that would be very hard to come back to you, but I wonder, you said earlier that you want to respect the viewer's intelligence.
Yeah.
And I think that it's respecting to the point that all levels of intellect are going to be confused on certain levels. And so I just want to know if anecdotally, if you have the sense that there's anybody out there who, you know, it just slides right down like butter for them, or, you know, if it's kind of an across the board confusion thing to some extent.
Well, I mean, it's embedded in subjectivity, so that's really hard to say. But I will say that, and it may just be personality too. I personally really enjoy when I go into an environment of viewing where I don't know what I'm looking at. That is like that's like a gift. Like, if I walk in a room and I'm like, oh my God, what am I looking at right now? That is like, that's like a pleasure to me.
What does it do to you?
Does
it do something to you more intellectually, conceptually, or does
it
also do something to you physically?
I just think in this kind of point in art history and culture, that's just hard to do. I just think it's hard.
Right.
You know, there's so much kind of, we've just seen so much. So it's just hard to do. So I just respect it. Like, I'm just like, you know, that's just amazing to me when that can happen still.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like just like a nice surprise or something.
But I think...
But there's more.
Yeah, but I think sort of wound up in what you're saying is, at what point does the line in the sand or the sort of dividing line, you know, exclude mm-hmm. a certain segment of the viewership?
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, that's tricky. Like, I had this one experience one time where, actually, this is a good anecdote to kind of talk about this. I was lecturing to, weirdly, at a museum, a group of docents, which is fascinating. And actually, afterwards,
we should go record that.
Yeah, I realized how interesting that was. Like, at first, I was kind of like, oh, sure, you know, that's makes sense or whatever. And then I realized, oh, this is actually really funny, particularly with my work, because it's really not designed to sort of have somebody holding your hand through it.
Yeah.
So I was very curious about what the hell, because I had a big piece in the museum, and I thought, oh, well, that's really interesting. Like, how are you walking people through this? And I didn't get as much of a sense of that because I didn't get a chance to, like, you know, interview them or talk to, you know, them as much. But I will say that I had one really interesting conversation because I was talking about the work kind of in a broader arc, not just the piece that was there, but I was talking about, you know, kind of the last 5 years or so. And I ended, I think, with that piece because it was the most recent thing I'd done. And I talked about this idea of asking a viewer to meet halfway and saying, well, similar to what I just said a few minutes ago, like, I'm interested in creating a situation where you have to work a bit, you have to read a bit, and you may not come up with some kind of legible answer, but then we're conversing. Doesn't matter. We're just conversing. But the trick is to make it so that it doesn't alienate. That's the tricky balance. Can you do it without alienating? And I think that the way I've tried to do it is to figure out how to introduce a level of just familiarity or human. I mean, I think it's maybe why I look at my space, because everyone can sort of relate to, like, a book or a wall or, you know, there's sort of like these basic components that everyone has some relationship to. How they're treated is something else, but, like, you know what, you know, a piece of paper is or whatever. You know, you sort of have that kind of written relationship to some degree. Anyway, so I had this one guy who said, because I talked about this one installation, and I did in the context of a lecture, I usually will explain, like, some backstory or my decisions to choose a certain element, and that's kind of a benefit for a lecture, because to me that's a totally different legibility. It's after the fact, it's looking at the work in this mediated, you know, dark room, slideshow, that kind of thing. And so the language or whatever that I accompany is totally different than when I accompany the actual show, because that's not, you know, how you see things. So anyway, so I went through this kind of elaborate thing, and afterwards this guy was like, you know, I'm really interested in everything now that you've talked about it, but how am I supposed to know any of that? And I said, well, you're not. This is you're getting like a benefit because of this talk, but my hope is that, you know, the forms that you experience are compelling enough to make you want to know. You don't have to know. That isn't the goal. It's not a goal-oriented thing. It's not like you get the prize or you get the you know, you get to the end of the maze. I'm like, it's just the thing. You know, like, that's the thing. And then, and so we had a little argument, like a friendly argument about that in the context of this talk. And he's like, well, you know, basically their job is to sort of illuminate the work. And I was like, well, that's like kind of a controversial position to me in a way, because for me, it's really important that you are bewildered if someone's telling you what to think.
So maybe your macroscopic position should have been to to give the docents leave for the length of
their
show.
Every time you see my work in a museum, get the hell out of the... for sure. Get the hell out. I thought that was actually a really interesting thing, and I was like, oh, this is like a perfect scene for like a novel, you know, like an artist and the docent like fighting it out. But I also at that time said, or it's like a perfect equation somehow. It's like, oh, that's so funny. But you know, I think the point in which we're disagreeing to this guy, I said the point in which we're disagreeing is that you have a contract in mind when it comes to looking at work. You have a contract that says, when I look at something, I need it to tell me X. I am, don't worry about what you're looking at, whether it's a, you know, just don't worry about it. The work is to renegotiate that contract. Does that make sense? And then I got through, I think, because I think he was like, I was like, that's the project. It's not like, oh, you like textiles or like you like, you know, sneakers or whatever. I was like, it's to renegotiate what it means to look at something. It's to reevaluate that. The stuff happens to be what it is because I'm me and I have this, that's the kind of environment that I'm living in. So it's what I know. It's speaking to my immediate, it's local reporting. That's how I describe it. So.
Local reporting.
Yeah. You know, it's like, what's here? So why would I talk about something I don't know about to analyze, you know, it's about like taking apart universal things by looking at the local. That's like my little, quick, if I have to break it down to one.
Your spiel. Yeah.
My spiel. That's
yeah.
my spiel.
Yeah.
No, but like, so yeah, so it's funny. So that contract, like the social contract is something I, or the viewership contract is the thing that I think about a lot. And so, and it's not like I'm just like, oh, it should be this way. It's just like sculpting it. It's like shaping it or, you know, manipulating it. So that becomes tricky because that means that the stuff ends up being really different all the time, which I think was really confusing for a long time. But I think, I think confusion is productive. But for some, you know, it depends on the proactivity level of the viewer. But I think, you know, to push the field forward, you gotta confuse.
This is now something that I asked Eric about too, but I think it's even more what I'm about to ask, which is, I think it's even more pressing here based on everything that you've been saying, which is how does the work then become consumable, you know, and does that then become the dealers? Do the dealers then become sort of the docents to the collectors? You know, I mean, I know you sort of made clear that you both have, you know, both sides. You know, you have the local and you have the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. You have the seductive and then you have the sort of the thwarting of the seductive.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but the collector wants seductive.
Right. Well, hopefully they want, I mean, yeah, I guess, but I guess hopefully they want a representation of the practice that is significant. That would be my, you know.
So they're going for the art historical, is what they're going
for. My non-cynical, like when I'm being really, you know, cheery about it all. But like, yeah, I mean, you're right, I'm sure. I think across the board, though, it's maybe not always true. Because I have encountered some really ambitious collectors who they think more about the arc of a career and they think about things like the objecthood actually becomes sort of irrelevant. I mean, not entirely, but at a certain level, I think, I mean, sure, it's about investment too, but it's also about like, well, is this like an important moment for this artist? Is this like an early moment? Is this like a transitional moment? I think when people are really thinking about the broader arc, then it stops being about like if it matches or if they want to live with it or whatever, you know. And that's exciting to me because that's when it's a real relationship, basically. And it's not just pork bellies or what have you. Although there is that aspect.
But they've got both sides too. They've got the pork belly side.
Yeah.
And then they have the intellectual curiosity side.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's conquest. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes into collectorship that's, I wouldn't even begin to say that I know about. The things that I own in my life, art wise, are friends and our own things. And, you know, so I haven't gone down that road so much. I can project based on my exposure what the psychology of the collector is, but that's also
like, I think just the large right. I think just the larger point here though is that
it is
counterintuitive
that
your work, you know, would be so well collected, and it appears to be so, and you know, just based on everything we've been saying.
But also I, from the beginning of even ever selling a piece of art, I wanted to be part of that process maybe more so than some people, like, meaning that, you know, because context is such a huge material in all of the work. To me, that extends to sort of its next life, meaning outside of exhibition, when it goes to a place of its its final rest. No, where, when it goes to its, like, you know, next stop or whatever, however you want to call it. Like, to me, that is part of the life of the work. And so I whenever possible, like to have my hand in that too. Because for me, that becomes an interesting way of thinking about, like, the identity of something is not just being like it on a wall in a white cube or like a rarefied viewing presentation. It's not. It's like when people collect art, they live with it and weird shit happens. Like, they can't fit it in this particular room, so they have to, like, stick it in this other room, and then they put it next to what people put things next to just automatically completely shifts, especially with what I make. And because what I make is often about these kind of, like, mixed company relationships and, like, weird juxtapositions and responses to architecture, for me it becomes super interesting to see where things end up. So if I can, I always try to, like...
Have you ever retrofitted work at people's homes?
Yeah. Or, you know, played a role in figuring out where it goes and what it could be with and what that conversation then becomes and, you know, stuff like that. And that's always great because to me that becomes like the work basically plugging back into its origin. It's like the loop finishes or something. It's like, because that stuff comes from life, and then for it to, I mean, it's not, you know, exactly, but, you know, there's this sensation of it kind of like, okay, now it's sort of been embedded amongst sort of other, you know, gestures, both domestic stuff.
Right.
And, you know, like the articles of like a human life or the residue of a human life, as well as other art objects. So that becomes like a bigger way that, to me, it becomes analytical too. Like it can create these new kind of combinations that weren't even remotely anticipated or intended, you know, in exhibition.
Yeah.
So, and I'm also, I'm pretty controlling, like, as far as, I mean, not controlling, but I am controlling as far as how I ask the dealers to talk about the work and think about it in terms of their systems. So from the very beginning, I intentionally tried to meddle with that system a little bit. So dumb things like, which maybe now seem pretty commonplace, but at the time, maybe, you know, whatever this is, seemed exciting. And it's still exciting, but maybe just because I've been doing it a long time, or less, seemed less radical or something. But, you know, for example, like I would make a wall panel in an exhibition that had four works on it. And each individual work would have its own title, and then the wall itself would have a title. So there'd be, like, sabotage to sort of the system of individually evaluating each work. So then your list gets fucked up. It's, like, about sculpting the gallery list. Like, how do you do that, then? Like, it's
I'm
about,
glad
like,
you brought that up, because that was one of the experiences of seeing Teeny Tiny Woman, you know, is that you're looking at this, you know, long list, and there's a lot of confusion, like which one goes with which piece, and then you realize that there's several pieces like a, within each piece.
Right, and that's almost like a performance of the first time I did that. It's like a penultimate, like, yeah, Russian doll, you know, like that was meant to be, you know, because that show was really intended as a survey. So from the beginning with that show, it was about looking. And so that became this infinite regress thing where it was like, holding the mirrors up, and it was like ding 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 ding, you know, because basically looking back at the practice, there's already sort of that gaze in the work, so it's like a double looking back, double retrospective. Yeah, so, you know, those complications, like complicating the collectability of something, I did some stuff that I'm not so much doing anymore, because I think at that time it was also reflective of me getting used to the idea of collectorship. So I would produce like a photograph or a textile piece that, or painted piece that came with an object, and they'd have to be together. Like, you have to take that little piece of baggage. There's like a messy little moment. You can't just have the pristine. And I think I was resisting against singularity at that time, because I was worried about
that.
So
you were starting to say earlier that you were trying to get the dealers to present what you're doing a certain way, and I didn't quite get if, you, well, if like that ended up coming off or not.
Well, yeah, I mean, it worked. I mean, I would, you know, I'm not present for all those conversations, so I don't know how much convincing, you know, but it, I mean, to some degree, you know, not everything. I mean, some things that I made a long time ago are still in storage here in this building. You know, it's not like everything. It's not like all of the work that's gone out to the world has been the collectible stuff and then everything else gets stored. That's not true. I've worked with a lot of really ambitious collectors who are willing to really take on something challenging, and that's a gift. But it's also, there's logistical problems and there's, you know, whatever else. And
yeah.
But just that awareness, I think it's, again, it's almost like asking the collector to be aware. Like, well, you can't just have that one thing. It's not like going into a shop and saying, I'm just going to take that one thing. You have this weird remainder that you have to deal with.
Remainder.
You know,
word.
Like a little like connective tissue to the thing. And it's not. And so that was me kind of fucking with that in the beginning. I'm less concerned with that now. And I think part of that has to do with feeling like confidence in the language. And also the longevity of the work has started to become such that I feel like a confidence in the individual things carrying the practice a little bit more. But that is because time is such a big element, and now time is actually a little bit more on my side. So there's some like memory and time are starting to be able to be materials that I can really work with. I think in that beginning moment, no one knew my work, so I was like, oh, I have to just like in really obvious ways like create a fracturing of the basic system that they're entering into. You know, I have to like fuck this up by creating some diversion or breaking their expectation a little bit. Like, no, you can't have just that painting, or you can't just have, or, you know, whatever, these two go together or whatever. And I think now, yeah, I mean, those things, depending on the context, I still do that, but it's not, I don't think I'm as insistent on it now, because I think when you see something, even though it feels disparate, I think you're able to more easily connect it to the things you've seen. And I don't feel like I have to instill that connection so literally, you know? So, yeah. What was it? You had something else that I was... I ended up, taking us down little side roads.
I thought you were going to say rabbit holes.
Get us back, rabbit holes.
I mean, there's so many different individual pieces that we could talk about,
yeah.
But I think we should go back to Italy and China. And we should move into the your oral history, as it were. We should talk about where you started before
my
all of
personal
this stuff.
History. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask you about it, so yeah. you don't have to just randomly start talking about it. So, where are you from?
I'm from Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah.
What part?
I'm from the north side of the city in a little nook called Edgewater, which, as you may gather from the name, is right by the lake.
Yeah, I think I've heard of it.
Yeah. So, but it's the city.
Right.
Which is like a stigma. And the only reason I bring it up is because, and I have a lot of friends in LA from Chicago, but I never, but most, well, a ton in LA, which is a topic.
Why do they come?
They come for very,
very different reasons.
Many reasons.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of Chi-town people here, which is cool. But oftentimes when you say, where are you from? This is like a whole thing that Chicagoans like chuckle about. People say, where are you from? And you say Chicago. And you're like, yeah, but where? And they'll be like, Naperville. Or, you know, wherever. You know, it's like not the city. So I'm proud to say I'm from the city. Literally from the city. It's a matter of pride.
Right, right. Because if you're from the suburb, you're not really
It doesn't really matter.
Way.
It doesn't really matter. But it's just a funny, like,
sure.
Little hiccup that everyone goes through every time they say, where are you from? Even though it's like, what? It's like 2 seconds if Naperville is 5 minutes away or whatever it is. I can't remember. But that's just a funny little...
So the fact is the fact that you're from Chicago and therefore the Midwest. Explain your kind and warm manners.
What'd
you say?
I'd say that's part of it. Yeah, there's an earnestness, sort of an openness and like a engagement.
Has there been any temptation, or have you do you recognize in retrospect any potential yearnings to become, you know, a difficult narcissistic artist in the rise of your success? at all?
God, that's a crazy question.
I know, it is. I could have put that more gently, but...
No, I liked how brutal it was. It was so brutal.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really... It's such a paradoxical question because it's really a way of saying, I can't believe how warm and nice you are.
Oh, thanks.
For somebody who, you know...
You're like, I thought
who's
you were
an artist
such
the way
a bitch.
That you are.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
That's a compliment. I appreciate it. It's very important to me in a basic sense, and I'm not trying to be like, you know, and I mean it when I say it, is all I'm saying. It's very important to, like, be a regular person, and that's always been a value system in my family and in Chicago, but particularly, you know, my upbringing. Like, being full of shit is, like, a really bad... danger, or like, you know, my family's very critical of people who are full of shit or just not down to earth.
Yeah,
that's kind of the condition. And so it's just, I think that I would wound myself deeply if I abandoned that, you know, like that's just important. I think getting flaky is a little like something that is also very important to me, that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And that's more of a real danger because that's just a reality of being a busy person. Like,
yeah.
You can get flaky and you're like, fuck, why did I become a flaky person? I'm not a flaky person, but that's the thing that I feel like I could have a weakness because I do get overwhelmed. But I always have good intentions.
Well, I just to add on to my generous compliment, you have been, you know, very politely responsive. In ways that you know,
that's nice.
That belie your you know, your incredibly busy
life. Yeah. I think I took like 6 months to email you back.
Well, actually,
the first time.
Well, actually, since in case people aren't listening to the Eric Frydenberg conversation, you and Eric.
Oh, he was kind of speaking on my behalf a little bit.
No. What I was going to say is that. That you, for people who don't already know, that you are partnered with Eric Frydenberg.
That's right.
who is in another podcast now. And basically it's been a tag team effort where Eric was the one who I communicated with at the beginning.
Oh, that's right.
And then as we led up to the actual meeting, you were the one who was doing the conversing.
That's true. That's because when you first emailed, I was on deadline, so he stepped up to get my back. And then vice versa, he was doing something else, pushing out a deadline. So we get each other's backs. But I generally have like it's a matter of pride to get back to emails really fast or else I feel like a total asshole.
Yeah.
So I just feel like, you know, that's like, I try to respect people's time. It's a very important factor. And I don't always get the same back, which is too bad. But most people, I think if you are like that, whatever, you reap what you sow kind of thing. Like that's just... I don't know. Is that
that's
so...
That's a really...
It's just
that's
basic.
That's a really ecumenical
it's
analogy.
It's so basic. It's like, just don't be a dick and probably people will be pretty awesome. So
no,
I actually... Yeah. I would like to say that I feel like generosity is really important on the part of artists. And I would like to think that to some degree, you know, and I've had ups and downs. It's not like everything's all great all the time. It's like, you know, things are harder than they seem even when they seem great. But I would like to think that the successes I have had have come, you know, from being generous. And I think that that's another kind of personal code thing that comes in.
Yeah.
And it's not just like, returning emails. I think the work too, like a generosity, what I was saying before about the respecting intelligence, I think that's a form of generosity. I think that's like super important work. I mean, it doesn't have to be like... in like a literal sense, like giving you a lot of like seduction. That's our word tonight.
But that does kind of go along naturally with the territory of what you do.
You know,
I mean, it's not like you're choosing to be generous with your work. You're just making it work, right? You're never at a crossroads where you say, should I be generous here? Or should I say,
mostly it's natural. But I do think like, I think about it a lot when I encounter other artists or their work, or I think about that role, or I think about that quality when I meet people, and I always value it when I meet someone really generous via their work or just regularly, you know. And I also, I think, like I'm not teaching right now, but I do a lot of like visiting artists stuff.
For like a semester or?
No, like a day.
Uh-huh. Sure.
So I do a lot of like going to grad students.
Out of town too?
Yeah, all over. Like, I travel a bunch for that. And, you know, I'll do like a day of visits and then like a lecture or something. And I really love that because I think part of it is I remember when I was a student in that position, which is so, you're so vulnerable. I felt very vulnerable. And I always felt like it was really generous when someone would come in my studio and spend an hour with me. I always thought, God, that's so awesome. You know, I really didn't feel entitled to it. And maybe that's just, you know, something too. Like, I do think there's a lot of entitlement out there, which is too bad. And I think that, like, I think it's important to remember, like, this is, I mean, maybe just because there is an art market here, there tends to be a sense of entitlement, I think, in some people. Like, I came from a city where you didn't expect to make a living, ever. That was not even on the menu. Like, that wasn't a possibility. It was for international artists who would then return. You know, it wasn't for, you know, a young, smart person.
Well, speaking of which, you kind of have helped me segue into something I was going to ask, which is, yeah, exactly. I mean, you were showing some in Chicago in galleries, yeah. Right? So coming to LA was still about extending those possibilities.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. I mean, Chicago is the most awesome city. It's the greatest city. But I personally was able to see my ceiling there, and I had to go. And there is a stigma there about people leaving a little bit, you know. And I hope, you know, it's kind of a drag because it's such an awesome city and it is a great place to be an artist. Like, it is most supportive, tight-knit, intelligent, academic, culturally infused. Like, it is the best city. And I mean, the combination of reasons why I had to leave were not just art. You know, I grew up there. Like, you have to go. It's like, I couldn't walk around with a ghost anymore. I was like, I gotta go. It wasn't just art, but that was also part of it. It was, I felt like I needed to be in an environment where, I hate to say it, I'm gonna sound like, and my Chicago friends are mad, but like, there's more possibility. There was more possibility. I could have.
That's a very fair comment.
Yeah. And so that was very hard to do on some level. And since then, lots and lots of, or before me and since then, it's not like, I started something. But, you know, lots of people have left. And there's always this question, like, why do people leave? And I process it like this. For me, it was it was the place to be a young artist. And the reason is the things that I hopefully hold sort of to my personal code now, which is I don't make it to make a living. I happen to, and I'm lucky. But I make it because it has to be the best work. And that's what everyone there does, is makes the best work they can, not for the entitlement or the reward, because there's really less... I mean, there's more mechanisms now to have a career there, frankly, than when I left. But they make work for the right reasons. And that is, like, the best education to kind of take... for me to take here and plant those seeds and do something else. So yeah, it's a touchy subject because it's the weather and it's my parents. I can't live there. But other than that, it's like an
sensible,
ideal fucking city. It's an ideal city.
Yeah.
What with all the global weirding, we all may be living there soon.
if the
weather,
the
I don't
there.
Know. If the, yeah, exactly. Keep them on yourself. No, if the weather were good, it's like perfect city. But actually, the weather is part of the psychology too, so you can't remove that either.
Yeah.
It's important.
Right.
But yeah, also I hadn't gone to grad school. There's some pragmatic things and, you know.
Where did you go to undergrad?
Artist. So.
Got it. So yeah, that was a lot of time you put in.
There. I did. And my parents both went to the art institute too.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Are either of your parents artists?
Both my parents were artists. My mom is no longer an artist. She's a scientist, basically.
Mm-hmm.
my dad still makes art and is still an artist. But my dad went for painting, and he was a photographer, like, for trade. So he would photograph artists' work, which is actually probably, aside from my college education, the best education. Because he would drag me to studios and stuff. And then, which I think precipitated like my interest in sort of production sites and things. But if I really look deeply. And then my mom was a photographer. And then when I was around like 10 or 11, she went back to school and got like a botany degree. And so she's like a conservation ecologist. She works at the, and she's been doing it for a very long time, but she works at the Field Museum.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right.
But she's still, she is a very creative mind.
Right.
She's not producing work, but she...
Well, what kind of experience, in light of what we were talking about earlier with, you know, people's interfacing with your work, what kind of experience do you think have you heard your parents have had?
With my work?
Yes.
Well, it's interesting because they're savvy viewers. They're more savvy than, say, the average parent.
Sure. Huge. That I would presume. Yeah.
Yeah, which is huge. Like, I've never had to validate, obviously, like, the idea of even being an artist at all, which I feel incredibly lucky. Because, you know, many people I know have had to.
Sure.
But I think it's interesting. I think that, like, any generational divide, there's going to be some stuff that falls through the cracks. And also, because they were artists, my dad's still an artist, they inevitably compare the condition of then to now and kind of like calculate that math all the time. I don't know. I'll say this. My parents are very supportive and very proud.
Right.
I don't know if I can say 100% they always get what I'm doing, whatever, air quotes, I'm doing air quotes. but like, you know, they also are every viewer. So that's fine. Like going back to all this stuff we talked about before, you know, I wouldn't expect them to understand the intricacies of all of it, but like, but they're very supportive and they've come to lectures and, you know, they've heard the, you know, they've heard it all.
So now they've heard the spiel, they can bring that with them to see your work and get a little bit better.
Trust me, my dad will forward this to everybody on earth. So you'll get your widest, your most insane Midwestern pinging of all time.
Nice.
They're good. I have had some funny conversations with my dad where, and he's like super, you know, excited about, you know, he's very supportive. He follows everything and he's a fan. He's a big fan. But I have had some funny conversations with him, which I think it has actually informed his work a little bit too, which is interesting because he started as a painter. And so he was at the Art Institute in the mid-60s, and he painted like alongside the Imagist painters, and he was kind of friends with those guys. And, you know, then he made a bunch of like sculpture and some, you know, other stuff. So, but now he kind of primarily makes assemblage. He's starting to do ceramics, but he does like assemblage and painting and drawing still. He draws every day. Like he'll get up and draw for a couple hours at least every day. He came and visited and we were just sitting here and there was like 10 minutes where we were like waiting for someone to come pick us up. And he like just, you know, drew for a while. So he, you know, that is like sort of his imprint, you know, he comes from more of a, I don't know, a classical mode. So I had a conversation with him where he said, this is early. This is like when I just got out of grad school and he did come see my thesis show. And I think he was really confused, like, whoa, what, but he said something like, you kids are so conceptual these days, you know, it's really something else. And he said, you know, when I was in school, and I actually don't even think this is entirely true. I think this is his absorption of the information because, you know, we know the history. It's mid-60s. There's certainly plenty of conceptualism, et cetera, going on. He's like, we were taught to make a beautiful object. And I was like, in your painting department. Finish the sentence with in your painting, you know. So it's funny. So there's some gaps, but there's also the ability to have a conversation about it at all at a level that's higher than probably a lot of other parents. So it's cool. It's cool. But there are times when I have to, what happened? There was a funny anecdote. He came to the Mocha show and somebody asked him a question about the work. And I was like, oh, now this is interesting. How are you going to answer that? Yeah. No, he told me about it.
Okay.
And it was like something like, what does that specific element in something mean? And he said, and I don't think he meant to, but it was like a great answer. He was like, it doesn't matter. I don't know if that's what, like, he didn't mean it in the way that I like that.
Yeah.
But it was kind of great. I don't know. It was kind of funny.
Well, speaking of relationships, your partner is Eric Frydenberg.
Yeah.
And you guys, we should just sort of set people up by saying that I got a little tour with both of your guys' studios, and I kind of had a sense, you know, from the email communication and then the fact that you showed the same gallery and you share a studio, you know,
that you're very
intertwined. Exactly.
We're very intertwined.
And so, I mean, I already talked to Eric and, you know, it sounds like, you know, it's very helpful. It's very, it's good symbiosis and so on. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe you can add a take on it that I haven't heard from him. So what's the question? Yeah. I mean, I guess, so the question is, I mean, is it all upside? I mean, you already told me, we should just say, you know, before we started on mic that, you know, you can't really imagine being with a non-artist. It's kind of what you said.
Yeah. I think mainly because, in my own sort of self-deprecating mind, I feel like I wouldn't want to put that neurosis on someone without them understanding what that process is.
That's
like.
Very thoughtful.
Not that anyone can't be neurotic. I just mean it's specific, you know, and you have a relationship with this thing that becomes a big part of your life that I think for someone who may be, I mean, certainly there are other fields that are consuming and play that role the same way, but at least for me, the way my practice plays a role in my world, it would be very hard to translate that to somebody. I don't know. Or that's my hunch. But then again, like, I don't know. I can get along with anyone, so I guess I could probably do it. It'd have to be the right person. I don't know. It would have to be.
Well, I guess since you brought it up, were you with non-artists before?
No. Except, like, in high school.
Okay.
But that doesn't really count. That's,
kinda,
like, pretend.
Yeah.
Like, pretend.
So
stuff.
You really wouldn't know, I guess. But you don't have to know.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, no, it's very functional, which is really cool. It's like, I think we both are, like, with Eric's work and with his music, he is very tuned into balance and rhythm. I know that sounds really fucking stupid, but I think I am too in a weird way, and so our temperatures are well matched, if that makes sense.
Well, here's a question. Let me just interject for a second.
Yeah.
Because I asked Eric, I've been introduced.
Oh, it's like the Newlyweds, or like, what is that show? Like you ask the same question.
Newlyweds.
Hold up the card.
Yeah. Newlyweds. I got introduced to the Myers-Briggs personality thing and I've ended up learning a lot about it. That's really fascinating and very practical. And so one of the, there are four categories. One of the four categories is you're either one or the other of two options in each category. So one of the options is thinker or feeler.
Now,
I asked Eric this. I'm not going to tell you what he said. But no, I said that I thought my hunch was that both you and he were both thinkers.
Oh.
And he thought that you were probably right on the fence, actually.
Yeah, I don't know that test. I mean, I know it, but I haven't done it.
But you can intuit what it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm
it's like the hyphenated name.
There you go. Good analogy.
In fact, I've used that as an analogy many times. It's like my aesthetic. It's like, it's all
intertwined.
It's all hybridized and tacked together. It fits and it's all good, but it's
right.
It's not a contiguous. It's like, it's got hemispheres. It's got parts.
Interactive hemispheres.
Yeah. But no, I mean, I think that, like, yeah, I'm probably both. I mean, he's both too, but I think that, like, our temperaments are, because I'm, like, you know, in public, a very, like, reasonable person, but I can be very unreasonable. And he is very, very patient. It's the Italian thing. Like,
he seems pretty stoic.
He's very patient. He's not stoic. He's actually he's measured, but I've never encountered a person so patient. And I think that there's part of me that knows that this is like this is a project, and he does a really good job.
Well, in what kind of ways have you tried his patience or tested?
It's hard to say. I'm pretty neurotic. Ultimately, I'm pretty neurotic. So, you know, just like irrational shit. It's like not even like, it's just like being crazy, basically. But I mean, at the same time, you know, I'm a kind person. I'm not like an abusive partner or anything like that. I just have systems that are weird. And he's super patient, and our temperatures meet really well. And so we're able to kind of coexist in a way that is really like supportive and respectful of each other's space. I mean, we share a house and we share this space, but we have our separate, you know, kind of little zones in each, and we're able to kind of like keep our, I think we know when things should be meddled, and we're pretty good now at knowing when they shouldn't, and like have a good sense of, you know, where we draw those boundaries and stuff. And I mean, that takes a while to do too.
Yeah, speaking of boundaries, because one thing that I'm really curious about, kind of with any artist couple, is, you know, at what point, you know, you're really passionate about what you do and about art. At what point is it like, oh, that's too much? You know, I'm overflowing. Yeah. You know, this is overkill.
Yeah. In the work, I mean?
In just in conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not necessarily about your work, but just like, oh, that's too much art talk. I need a break from art talk.
God, I don't think that's happened yet. I feel like it's all due.
That's what I mean. So it's the symbiosis. Yeah, it's like 24 hours a day,
right? I actually think that that's not true. I think that sometimes we'll be like, I think that there'll be some like symbiotic, like we need a break. And that usually doesn't happen as much as we'd like to. And we probably should take more breaks. But I think that like our dialogue is a really big part of our lives. And so, you know, I think we both take pleasure in it, even though sometimes, you know, we definitely like will complain to each other. I mean, it's not like all like, you know, completely productive, like, you know, critique all the time or anything. No, it's like you're bitching about where's that check or like what's, you know, what's happening. And, but it's still about art, you know, it's still like around the topic of art.
What's your secondary topic?
Television. With him, politics, news. He's a kind of a news junkie.
Uh-huh,
I am too, but I kind of see it as more of an abstraction. He follows the nitty gritty details.
Right.
It's too painful for
me. Right.
It's painful.
Yeah, I'm on some.
But I follow the broad brushes and
care
very much, of course. But I also to the point, I don't know. It gets overwhelming. I get overwhelmed by it. Depends on what's going on. I mean, we're talking about the election nonstop for sure recently, but that was because that was what was happening. So current events, I guess, but and TV. When we get TV, sometimes we'll go, you know, a really long time without having TV because we'll be here and we won't watch any TV, and then we'll get like a slightly easier schedule, and then we'll, you know, maybe get into some television. So we'll talk
something about intelligent, presumably.
Well, I don't know how do you.
Well, I mean, there's crap, and then there's, you know, there's television that's making movies look bad.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. A little bit of both. Like, you know, we liked
reality shows?
Well, here and there. He hates reality. I enjoy reality.
Do you
want to
out
TV.
Yourself with a particular reality show that you watch?
I watch Drag Race.
I don't even know that.
RuPaul's Drag Race.
Oh, right. That's actually supposed to be pretty sophisticated for a reality
actually think it's very sophisticated.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of... Okay, let's say this. I think the reason why I'm attracted to that show is that it enacts some things that I invest in, which is in the shell of a kind of like empty kind of format, because it's the same format as like, you know, Project Runway or anything. It's very... format. It actually is pretty smart because it keeps that format, but it's pretty subversive in terms of what you're actually looking at, I think. So I actually really like that show, and I don't actually categorize that necessarily as one of my dumb shows. Sometimes I'll slip into like recently I was looking around because we had a minute, which was rare, and I found this show about Strange Obsessions. Do you know this show?
Sounds I don't like a watch cousin a, of Hoarders or something.
I don't, yeah, basically. And yeah. It's super terrible, voyeuristic, exploitative,
right.
awful.
Right.
But I have to say there's like a poetic element that I couldn't tear myself away from, which had to do with each episode was centered on, they would pair two neurotic people, or not neurotic, obsessed, like addicted, strange addictions. That's what it is. Sorry. I didn't watch enough of it because he was like, no, no more. He was like,
she's making the cross the throat motion.
Yeah, yeah. But so it was like each episode was two people, but the menu for the show was actually pretty good because it would be like, it would just list their addictions. For example, eats glass / bleaches skin. That was one. Eats couch cushion. This is an addiction. This woman eats her sofas. She literally eats the foam out of the sofa seat she's sitting on.
Right.
/ married to a doll, which was a guy who was married. Well, he in his world was, well, actually, I think they had some sort of ceremony, which brings up other issues. With a real doll. No, not a blow up doll. A real doll. You know what those are? They're like.
The really expensive high end ones.
Super, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, so that's the one vice. But usually we watch, we watch like a quality series, like The Wire. You know, the good stuff. Right now we're watching Walking Dead, which is pretty good. And we're watching Walking Dead in the interim of waiting for Breaking Bad to come back, which we were also watching.
Breaking Bad's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, super good.
Yeah.
And it's not like I'm making it out like we watch a lot of TV. We don't watch it.
No, I get that. Yeah.
But that's like, you know, the one little vice that's like, you know, not here, which is cool.
Yeah.
Which is what our new place kind of helped indoctrinate, because it was like a comfortable place to like chill out and watch a movie or watch TV. So that happens. What else? That's it. It's mostly art. I mean, we like, it's not all sunshine. I mean, we share a lot of, you know, frustrations too. And so that becomes, it double everything. So, because oftentimes, because we're in the same field, inevitably, if you have a frustration, they're going to have a similar one. So everything's doubled. So that.
But they don't necessarily have the same.
No. I just mean in general, you know, when you're.
Your empathy comes out because it's like, oh shit, I
know. Or you're dealing with similar problems regularly, whether they're yours or someone else's. Yeah. So that becomes an issue. But also, like, the way I describe it sometimes is that, like, I speak Eric. Like, I can, like, what I actually am really proud of about our relationship is that I can go into his studio and give him feedback through his eyes, not mine. And that is really special because that's really hard to cultivate except with really, really close friends. I mean, that's, but I think even close friends don't have that intimacy that we have because it's so kind of longstanding at this point that I think he can also do the same for me. Like he can come in and he would give me feedback based on not what he would want to do if it were his work, but what he really knows I would want to do. So it helps. Introduce an objectivity that's like a third brand. It's not quite, it's like objective subjectivity or something, which is really cool because that's like super hard to come by, I think. And I think that's the thing that we help each other with the most. We've never collaborated per se. Like we've never made things with each other, really, although we've made hundreds of things alongside each other. We've helped each other with physical tasks and things like that. But what I mean is we've never authored anything that was a combined vision.
Right.
Necessarily. Except for the world that we live in, I guess.
Yes, you have made the world you each
to
live it together.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Should we close with some titles?
Oh, you have some? Oh nice. Sure.
Well, I mean just some titles from some of the shows and whatnot.
Yeah, totally.
So there's let's see. Nothing fucking matters. We'll go chronologically. Half of what I say is meaningless. Frauds for an inside job. And then I love this one. Vertical plot, parentheses. Dark matter community garden with backwards purpose. Somebody stop me. The Cheshire Cat Principle. A stack of black pants. That's double right. Tragedy.
Double Tragedy is a series of works, not a show.
That's right.
But yeah, but
that's
it's a
right.
recurring...
I put that in parentheses because that was from that
yeah,
show.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a recurring trope that's come in many
You
times.
Have something against actors?
No.
Just kidding.
No. But that is funny.
Yeah, I mean, the humor that we talked about at the beginning mm-hmm. exists as much yeah. in the titles
yeah.
as anywhere.
Right, but they're also like Nothing Fucking Matters was a... kind of the first time I had an opportunity to do a big solo show here, and I was thinking very much about that. I mean, the language is really important, and it functions both as like almost like diagrams a little bit of what you're seeing. You're really meant to. I like to think of the title of the show as like this quick little, not just like a referent, but like really encapsulating some kind of like structural thing that the whole show is encapsulating. So Nothing Fucking Matters was this moment where I was really introducing myself, and that felt like, I actually don't remember initially where it came from, to be honest. I'm trying to think. I think I was just thinking about, well, actually, that's not true. I do know. When I was in grad school, I wrote a lot of things about the idea of everything. And so there's also this constant, like, discussion of everything and where those boundaries lie, you know, and what that is. And I made this book in school called Absolutely Everything. And so that term was really bandied about. And of course, I was still interested in that. And that became, like, an inversion of that. But I also wanted to create a piece of language that, like, deactivated itself in terms of what it is. It's, like, this kind of, like, cocky, vaguely nihilist thing.
And that is a perfect encapsulation of what yeah. you do with your work too.
Which
right? And
cocky.
No. No, it de-encapsulates everything
yeah.
that's in it.
Yeah. Yeah. There you are.
Well, I'm so glad we
well
finally
done.
Got to talk.
I like you like locked it all up.
I was looking for the lockup.
That's awesome. No, thanks for coming. That was super fun.
Excellent.
Come
Cheers.
Back again anytime. Cheers.
Cheers. She holds up a fictional glass. Yeah. And we're out.
Oh, introduce.
Okay, that's it. You made it through. I hope that was incredibly satisfying and entertaining for you. Thank you for listening. I do want to let you know I've been doing this at the beginning of podcast, but I'm saving it for the end today. I have been trying to expand the show, and that means I need new equipment, and I do need your help. I am really calling out to you for a modest contribution. If you haven't contributed already, please consider donating to the show as little as $5 or $10. You can do it through PayPal, through the Podomatic site, which is linked on the new website. You can also send a check. Just contact the Gmail address to get contact information there. But please do contribute to the show so that we can get new equipment and expand the conversation podcast. I would appreciate it very much. So thank you in advance for your help. I appreciate it. All right. I'll talk to you later. Bye.